Welcome to Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. This is Movie Dude Eric, your host that won't require you to pet the monkey.
And I'm David S. Dawson, host of the Intellectual and Sci-Fi Sunday podcasts. I've been a filmmaker for 20 years, and there's nothing I love more than analyzing film.
And in this episode, we're discussing Outbreak, starring Dustin Hoffman, Rene Russo, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Spacey, Cuba Gooding Jr., Donald Sutherland, and directed by Wolfgang Peterson. David, welcome to Art House Legends Podcast. This is your first episode with us. How does it feel?
Good. Yeah. Let's get the energy going. Let's get this crazy Outbreak movie reviewed in the middle of an outbreak. What could be better?
I'll be honest here. When I figured out that our current situation, for those of us far into the future, you know, when our grandkids have an opportunity to listen to this podcast and they know that this is coming from the year 2020, that we had ourselves a slight little COVID-19 coronavirus, I kind of admit that my mind went straight back to two particular films. One was a Steven Soderbergh scare fest called Contagion. Mm-hmm. And the other one was this 1995 film that I remembered fondly in my teen years called Outbreak. Now, I have to ask, David.
Yeah.
How were you made aware of Outbreak? Did you watch this initially in the 90s or did you come at it more recently?
No, I was in college studying theater when this film came out. And... you know, with the likes of Dustin Hoffman and Morgan Freeman and Rene Russo in it and Donald Sutherland, there was no way that a theater kid couldn't go watch this film. You know, like it was required watching anything with Dustin Hoffman at the time. You had to go see it in the theater. So, yeah, I saw this in the theater in 95, which, you know, seems like a long time ago now, but, you know, isn't that far back that you can't remember it, unlike some leaders who say nobody saw this stuff coming.
Now, I'll be honest here. When I originally saw this film, at the same time, I was reading a book from Richard Preston called The Hot Zone. Are you familiar with this book?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't read it.
Well, that's the funny thing. Most people are familiar with the book, but they've never read it. And the thing is that I read the book not realizing that Outbreak was actually inspired by this book.
Yeah. Well, that's why I know about the book. And I think I even bought the book, but I ended up not reading it. But I do that a lot. I prefer to watch the movies, you know.
But yeah, it's just that, so Outbreak in the Hot Zone specifically, Hot Zone painted this very scary idea of what a viral outbreak would look like. And this was also around the same time that a television adaptation of Stephen King's The Stand came out, which I believe was like a year before this. And so, I understand that at this particular point, I'm 14 years old. The Hot Zone is not exactly a book for teenagers. You know, it's really it's a more heavier book. But I was enthralled by this as someone who still had aspirations for science and to become a scientist. That was my goal at that particular time. Before I got my first chemistry class and realized how inept I was at the whole idea of science. Have you ever been in that position where your passion just didn't make up for the skill that you had? And no matter how much you practiced and how hard you tried, you just didn't get anywhere?
Can I just pretend that I'm perfect and I've never had that problem?
That's fine. This is a podcast. This is not a court of law. But
then no, I don't know what you're talking about.
But yeah, the thing is that I had seen this movie, and the funny thing was is that at this particular point, I was at the blooming phase of my film love. I had always been a fan of movies, but at this particular point, I was really starting to fall in love with them. You know, I was paying attention to filmmakers. I was paying attention to actors, not just the major stars like Dustin Hoffman. I was interested in character actors and paying attention to them. Bill Paxton became my spirit animal after I'd seen him in Aliens, The Terminator, and True Lies, all within the span of about 2 weeks. I mean, that's saying something. And I've talked about that on our Terminator and Aliens podcast. And RIP Bill Paxton.
Absolutely.
It still breaks me up. Anyway, so Outbreak comes out, and this is a movie that just from the credentials, I just felt in my blood that this was going to be an Oscar movie. Didn't get nominated for an Oscar.
No, it didn't.
That said, though, when I saw this movie, I absolutely loved it. And I've loved it for a very long time since. I would say all the way up until 2010, which was the last time I saw the movie before seeing it for this podcast.
Now, you mentioned that it didn't win an Oscar, but it was a nominee for the Saturn Award for Best Science Fiction Film.
It did.
Won some other kind of smaller awards, but did win Broadcast Film Critics Association Award for Best Supporting Actor for Kevin Spacey. So, I mean, it won some awards. It got some recognition. Just it didn't win the big ones. Didn't get into the Oscars. Didn't get the Golden Globe or anything like that.
And I will be honest here. Watching it for the podcast, I realized that this movie has, how do I say it politely, some serious 90s tropes. I will be honest here. I didn't.
Don't be so gentle. It is a bastion of 90s tropes.
It is. And we'll talk about what if this makes it endearing or cringy, because not taking my hand too much here, there's places in this movie I'm not really sure if it meets one of the other criteria. But that's why we have this podcast, right?
Absolutely. So,
let's go ahead and let's talk about this. Let's start off with these tropes, because let's be honest here. For a movie that already has an outbreak story, which is already in itself extremely dramatic, we also have conspiracy theories. We have lovers on the outs working together, which was a big thing back in the 90s. Quirky supporting characters, including some token characters. And we have a cute monkey. Now, in your opinion, does any of this age the film? Or if it does, is it for the better or for worse?
It absolutely ages the film. It is the quintessential film made during the baby boomers in charge generation. The baby boomers who were in charge of the studios by that point, they were directing the films. They were kind of really leading where Hollywood was going. They grew up in the era of Nixon. They grew up in the Vietnam era. They did not trust government. And so much of popular culture in the 90s is a reflection of that baby boomer view of government, right? Government can't be trusted. And whether it makes sense to throw it into a story or not, they were going to throw it into a story. And, you know, this was also around the time of the birth of the X-Files, and we all know how big the X-Files grew.
I'm still an X-File. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. But it surpassed just being, you know, the geeks who enjoyed the X-Files. The X-Files was enjoyed by a wide swath of really the world beyond the geeks, right? And God bless it. I think the X-Files was kind of like, you know, the doorway in for general culture to become kind of more in tune with pop culture, because suddenly they could talk to the geeks about something. Mm-hmm. But this film in particular, the outbreak part of Outbreak is the scary part of this film and should have been the focus. But because of that, kind of, it felt like a mandate in Hollywood at the time that you had to have the untrustworthy government officials, That stuff gets kind of rammed into this story and then really overtakes the story for the last half. And I think it's totally not needed. I think it really hurts the film overall. You know, it's, but you do get to see Donald Sutherland being a dick, which is kind of fun.
Well, I'll be honest here. When it comes to Donald Sutherland, for the most part, most of his characters are dicks.
Yeah. You know, so
I think the only time that I haven't seen him be a total dick was when he was playing, Mr. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. Which, I don't know if you've seen the recent rendition of Emma.
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Well, the thing was that while I was watching,
I don't know how many renditions of Emma I need to like suffer through.
Only two: Clueless and the new rendition. You can forget all the other ones. Just being honest. But the thing is that there was a great scene in Pride and Prejudice with Donald Sutherland where, in the book, he his wife is telling him that he needs to force his daughter to marry, and he plays the scene as though he's going to piss off either his wife or his daughter, and he's going to piss off his wife, and he knows that as soon as he says it that she's going to hit him, and he plays it just like that, and it is the best version of that scene ever. It is so good, because you can see it on his face, like, she's going to hit me. She's going to hit me. I need to just say this as quickly as possible so I can get out of this as quickly as I can. And that endeared me to Mr. Bennet and to Donald Sutherland. So, I mean, he's played other nice characters, but for the most part, he plays assholes. He's most well known for playing assholes.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'll be honest here. If you're going to have a mustache-twirling, evil 90s villain, you could do worse than Donald Sutherland.
For sure.
just being honest there. But I gotta say that when it comes to this, one thing that I find myself also kind of fascinated by is that this is directed by Wolfgang Petersen. Are you familiar with Wolfgang Petersen's filmography?
Yes, absolutely.
And so Wolfgang Petersen, this is the trifecta of Wolfgang Petersen's work is in the 90s, because before he did Outbreak, he did a little movie that actually got Oscar nominated, which was In the Line of Fire. In the Line of Fire came just before Outbreak. It got nominations for John Malkovich. It got nomination for Clint Eastwood. If I'm not correct, it got best original screenplay. If I'm not correct, I could be wrong on that one, but I know about Malkovich because that's where I fell in love with John Malkovich. And then after he made Outbreak, do you remember what film he did next?
Was that when Das Boot came out?
No, Das Boot was actually in the 80s. That was his claim to international fame.
Is it Air Force One?
Air Force One.
Yeah.
So this trifecta of Wolfgang Petersen's work is those three films. After that would be, if I'm not correct, this next film would be Troy, which of course I would love to talk about Troy, but I feel like that has to be set in two parts because there is the theatrical cut and then there's the director's cut.
Right.
And it's one of those occasions where the director's cut should have been put in theaters, and I don't know why. But the thing is that Wolfgang Petersen, and this feels like a Wolfgang Petersen film. It has, because one thing that he's really good at, and one reason why you get Wolfgang Petersen as your director, is if you need to constantly put pressure into a scene. As you mentioned with Das Boot, pressure requires time. And one good thing that he does with this is that over time, the pressure keeps building, the pressure keeps building, the pressure keeps building, the pressure keeps building. And he does have some relief. He does have the release valve that he uses, but he uses it very sparingly, and then he moves on. Just like with the personal lives of the protagonists. What I really love about how this film works, even today, is that you get these personal lives narratives that's in the film, you know, about the lovers, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Rene Russo divorced couple. That's in the film, and it's meant to provide character development for them. But one thing that I love about how they did it in this movie is that it just, it gives you like a line, and then it moves on. It doesn't relish in the personal lives. It gives you enough to know that, that it's something that's going on, but it doesn't lose its focus on the main problem of the virus. When it comes to the protagonists, we'll talk about the human villain. Well, no, because
I think it was overplayed.
Paying attention to it with this this screening, because literally, like let's talk about the dogs. At the beginning of the film, they establish that this married couple have these two large dogs that they love, right? The dogs are set up in a scene. We see that he gives her the dogs because he has to go to Zaire because of this virus. That's one line, and then it goes straight to the virus. They don't waste too much time on the dog. And then whenever they talk about, like when they're, the next scene when you have Kevin Spacey and Dustin Hoffman going into the thing and he's complaining about the dogs again at this particular scene, they talk about it as they're moving to the room. They don't waste time after they get to the room. After they get to the room, it's back to business, right? So it uses that character, those character moments to build up to the scene and to kind of give you that release valve so that when we get back into the virus plot, it's back to business with the characters. They're, at that point, they shut off that personal life stuff, and it goes straight into the story itself. And that's what I really appreciate about this part. When it comes to the villains, they should just cut all that out, right? I mean, the whole conspiracy theory thing, that felt like it was taking away from the true villain.
Well, I feel like the maybe the love story between the two of them would have worked better if it was just the focus on the two of them without the conspiracy theory. But for me, their relationship became too much about Morgan Freeman's character trying to use Dustin Hoffman's kind of continual belief that his wife, your ex-wife, no, my wife, no, your ex-wife, it became too rooted in trying to show Dustin Hoffman that his judgment was off.
Actually, no.
I hated that.
That's what I thought about the scene before, but as I was watching this time around, that is not actually where the focus is with the whole with that particular thing. And we'll talk about Billy's character, because out of all of the characters, Billy is possibly the most conflicted character, because he's really caught between these two worlds. He is a lackey for Donald Sutherland, right? For General McClintock. But he's also the boss, and he still considers himself a doctor first. He is a higher brass military man, but he still considers himself to be a doctor. And Sam constantly is reminding him of his responsibility as a doctor. So whenever he has that moment where he could arrest Sam, because you know he's the '90s outlaw, the '90s maverick. Although I have a hard time believing Dustin Hoffman as a maverick. I mean, even in The Graduate, I never bought him as a maverick. Okay, that's just the thing. He does not. I don't see him as that fly by the seat of your pants type guy. And there's a scene that I now absolutely hate because they try too hard to establish him as a maverick with the scene, but.
When he's telling the guy to change the orders on the flight.
I hate that scene now. That scene, no, if you think about it, if they would have taken that scene out, because the next scene after that is when Rene Russo is going into the town, right? If you didn't know that he'd already changed the orders, that if you thought that he was actually following orders and went to New Mexico, then when he shows up in the town, that's actually that actually creates a new dynamic, right? Because
it becomes a romantic dynamic at that point. But
yeah.
But again, the film tries to be too many things. It tries to be a hard science movie, and we can argue how good the hard science actually gets, especially as you get towards the end of the film. It tries to be a love story, and it tries to be a conspiracy film. And it's like, you can't be all three. Like, you need to pick one or the other. Maybe two, but not all three, because they end up colliding with one another and it doesn't work. Like that stuff makes the movie kind of fall apart for me.
It is trying to do too much, and I'm not going to disagree with you on that.
Like the opening scenes, though, like let's get into the science of it, right?
Okay, yeah.
The opening scenes when they're in that little village and everybody's bleeding out of their eyes and they got the pustules and, you know, even take away the, you know, the first guys who show up to take a sample and wander off and then they nuke the place. But even when Dustin Hoffman and Cuba Gooding and them show up, it feels like a really good hard science horror film is about to unravel, right? But then it goes off into this, they return back to the States and you get the discussion about the dog. And then I'm like, where the hell is this movie going? Why am I listening to these people pratter on about their dog? Like there's an infectious disease that's killing people super fast. What is going, why are they taking the time to sit here and talk about the dog, argue about the dog? It just deflates everything for me out of the movie. It's like every time the relationship comes on, I'm like, can we get back to the science stuff? That's really interesting. And maybe that's part of where we're at right now. Cause you know, like I'm watching death tolls every day on the news and listening to doctors and stuff talk about curves and, you know, how we need to isolate people and try and stop this thing from getting out. Like that's where the momentum was in the movie for me right from the start. And then boom, it just kind of stops with the love story.
Now, again, I'm not going to disagree with you on that. And I think part of me is that I just have to accept the fact that this is a 90s thing that they didn't feel comfortable just making about these scientists versus a virus. I think that they were also, I think they're also kind of stuck in a situation where, especially considering the producers for this film, because these are the same producers that made The Fugitive. This is Warner Brothers basically following a formula that they pretty much followed the entire decade, right? Warner Brothers during the 90s was not known for creating unique or different narratives. You know, it's like they went straight from, say, Unforgiven to The Matrix. And throughout the rest of that, rest of the decade, it was a standard formula that you had to follow with a Warner Brothers movie, right?
Yeah. You know, the formulas exist because they've got pencil pushers and accountants who think that that's what's going to put people's butts in seats. And I think what I see here is they didn't trust the story they had, which was the truly terrifying story of an outbreak. And they felt like they had to pad it with other stuff to make it palatable for a general audience. And God, I hate it when filmmakers don't trust the audience to take the ride with them. I just can't stand it.
You know, I agree, but this, I don't know. I feel like part of me has to just kind of look at the film as it is and not as I want it to be, because if I did that with every film that I watch, I could find myself disliking movies and not just accepting it on its own terms, you know? That said, though, I mean, we do get a version of this film that is hardcore science, which is Contagion, which also is a Warner Brothers movie.
Took another 20 years to get to.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, though, let's be honest here. That was a wild risk, even in 2012, for a movie like that to come out and to be successful. And let's be honest here, Outbreak, I think, made more money than Contagion did. But at the same time, though, I also have to just admit that even with this, watching it this time, this movie's a lot of fun. Say what you will about the extra padding, but like the action sequences that are completely a different movie than the virus movie were exciting. They were engaging. You know, when you have the helicopters chasing each other, when you have
the helicopter chase down the river is dope. I will totally give you that. But what makes that scene work for me within the context of this movie that's supposed to be based in hard science, and you've got a character like Dustin Hoffman, who's, you know, technically speaking, should be the smartest guy in the room in most rooms he walks in, right? He had the intelligence to fire the missiles into the trees to create a diversion and make them think that maybe they crashed and buy them some time. That I loved. I loved that sequence. I was like, okay, there's the action being fed with some of the character development that they've done. And I appreciated that tremendously. Now, the playing chicken with the bombing plane, I'm not sure that worked for me in the end, though. It felt really forced, too, with the way Morgan Freeman's character, like, hopped on the radio and gave him the idea, you know. It was like, oh, we got to find some way to make Morgan Freeman a hero. So let's give him something to do. It just, you know, they were like written into a corner now with this character that, you know, really didn't show any redeeming qualities the whole movie. Like, it never, you know, is like he, for all the character development they did with Dustin Hoffman and Rene Russo's characters, Morgan Freeman is like a blank slate the whole movie. He's just like military guy who follows orders and does what he's told. And there wasn't enough character development for him for me to like feel like, yeah, way to come around. You know, it was just like, okay, script's going to have him do something here to be heroic. Yay.
Well, the one thing I'm going to say, the biggest knock I'm going to make on this movie, and please feel free to disagree with me on this, is you have Cuba Gooding Jr. in the movie, and he literally doesn't even have a first name. He's the only semi-main character that has a rank and a last name. That's all he's got. And he doesn't have any character development, with the exception that he puked on his first assignment. Outside of that,
yeah, he's plot driven entirely. He's conveniently whatever the plot needs him to exposition. Be at the given moment.
That's what he does. he provides us updates on what's happening with the virus. He like the scene at the end, like when they find out about the bombing run. Technically speaking, he was in the middle of processing an antidote when he gets this information. Like, so you're telling me that he's not only doing viral work, but he's also listening to comms as well. Like, he's pulling double duty, and we're not even watching him do this. This is all happening off screen. Like, he's just there to spout exposition. And I don't know about you, but that just screams tokenism right there. Right?
Well, I don't know if it's tokenism. I mean, I just think it's lazy writing more than anything. And with a movie that's trying to stitch together three different storylines that don't really belong together, you kind of need that kind of sewing machine stuck onto the quilt to kind of put it all together. And I think that's just what his character is. He's not important in any way, shape, or form other than he has to stitch together these like disparate pieces of the story that they're trying to tell.
Yeah, I agree. The thing is like there's when it comes to the story elements of the film. There's a lot that, like, the thing that I really loved about this film, and I don't think you can disagree with me on this, is I love how the film describes the spread of the virus from the Motaba Valley back in 1967 to how the monkeys were infected, to how this one monkey gets captured. How it spreads to this ship, how it spreads to this warehouse, how this guy, McDreamy of all people.
okay, hold on. I'm totally with you. When the movie's on hard science, like talking about the spread of the contagion, it's fantastic. But Patrick Dempsey as a bad boy type, really?
He was an 80s bad boy type. I mean, have you ever seen Can't Buy Me Love? I mean, seriously.
Look, you can't throw an earring on Patrick Dempsey and a leather jacket and go, "Ooh, you're a dangerous bad boy now." It just doesn't work.
That's exactly who he was up to this point. I mean, that was his bread and butter. For the late 80s, early 90s. Come on.
Well, he was more in Can't Buy Me Love and stuff. He's more of like kind of like the rascal, you know, almost like a Ferris Bueller kind of, you know, he makes things happen, right? But this character is genuinely supposed to be like bad. Like he steals animals out of the arrival berth and takes them and tries to sell them. He's black market. He's underground. He's like he's a criminal, like full on criminal. And he doesn't sell it for me at all.
He is a rascal. Okay, so let's put it this way. If the monkey wasn't infected with a virus, would we not say that basically he's just a charming rogue? I mean, basically, he just stole a monkey to sell for some money. I mean, with the exception of it being theft, it's not the worst crime that you would see.
Maybe it's just the white guy fro I can't take.
for me, it was the earring.
I can't take anything he does in this movie seriously. The story around him is fantastic. But the white guy fro in the earring is just a little bit much. And it screams 90s. Like, if there's anything costuming wise in this movie that like sets the date for you, Patrick Dempsey's it.
But I don't know. I mean, I actually bought that. And what I also loved about it is that this monkey, which is a cute monkey, let's be honest here. And I actually like the fact that it is a cute monkey because it subverts your expectations. You don't think something that small and that cute would be responsible for so much death, right?
Hey, it's a totally cute monkey. And all I could think the whole time I was watching it is, why didn't it kill David Schwimmer? It's the same monkey from Friends.
Fair enough.
Could have saved us all a lot of grief and pain if it had just spread the disease in the right channel.
But the thing is so, I mean, I loved how it didn't just go into one direction, you know, because he takes it to the pet store. It infects both the other monkey that's in the store plus the pet store owner. We don't know about that until later in the movie. Or, you know, we don't see the effects of that until later in the movie. He had also infected the guy on the ship that we saw at the beginning of the film, but we don't know about that until almost at the end of the film.
Were you disappointed when the chopper got to the ship and there wasn't like just a bunch of those guys like bleeding out and dying on the deck?
No, because actually that was a brilliant
idea. Even when I watched the movie in the 90s, that's what I was expecting. I was expecting him to show up and like it had spread across the whole ship and everybody was dying. Yeah, maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just dark.
No, the thing is that that's actually a plot point because remember, African Mataba is not airborne. The reason why there was so much death in Cedar Creek was because it mutated to be airborne, right, that it could survive in the air. And that was the whole point of that there being two strains. The government conspiracy orange juice was able to get the ones that didn't have the airborne virus, but it couldn't save the ones that had the airborne virus.
Right.
Right. So the guy who was on the ship had the one strain, the non-mutated strain. So it only mutated once it got into Cedar Creek, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I understand how it fit for the plot. I'm just saying it would have been a way cooler cinematic moment to show up on Death Ship, you know? Like, but again, maybe that's just me. I'm just dark.
Mm-hmm. No, I get you. But that's the thing. That's where I feel conflicted when it comes to this movie, because there is a lot of stuff that I love about it. There is a lot of stuff that I really appreciate in its 90 campiness, but at the same time, though, considering that we're talking about something very serious, it almost feels like, you know how like terrorist in movies prior to 9/11 were, well, they were still a threat, but at the same time, you can be goofy about it and kind of take it right, not so seriously. But after 9/11, because it caused so much damage and destruction, you couldn't have that kind of goofiness and campiness with a terrorist movie.
Yeah.
You know? And yep. So I feel like maybe that's part of it, that and it's not specifically this current virus. I would say that probably SARS was where we started to really take these viruses seriously, especially as these outbreaks became more prevalent. It wasn't just like once every 10 years. We're looking now at once every 2 to 3 years that we'd have this happen. In fact, when President Obama was in office, he didn't face just one global epidemic. He faced two in his time. That's more than most presidents in their that's more than most presidents would ever see. And so as these become more prevalent and we start to see more deaths and we start to see these stories more up close and personal, we can't make fun of it like we could in the 90s, you know? And I think that that's part of it. I
honestly believe that this film was an attempt to take it seriously. I don't feel like they were trying to make fun of it or take it lightly. I just think, like you're saying, the kind of culture around the science of this stuff wasn't there yet on the whole. So they filled it with a lot of other kind of familiar storytelling tropes to try and make it palatable for an audience. Not make it lighter, not to take it lighter, but just because they thought that the science maybe was too hard and too brainy for a general audience, so let's throw some things that they feel more comfortable with in there so that they get kind of the gist of what we're telling them, and it's wrapped around, you know, some kind of entertaining action and stuff that they're familiar with, because, you know, again, they don't trust the audience until something like a global pandemic actually rolls through the world and terrorizes the population. They don't feel like anybody's got the stomach for an actual story like that, you know?
I guess you have a point there to an extent. But at the same time, I feel like that's Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers played it very safe. I think that they put all their experimental films, the films that that were pushing the boundaries, over to New Line Cinema at the time, because,
well, let's be honest, the 90s was the period of the small labels like Miramax, New Line. All the big studios had those little houses that they would ship off their kind of like harder edged material to, you know, where the kind of like overhead and risk was managed better, you know?
Yeah, I will say that's definitely it. But I think that, especially for a movie like Outbreak, you couldn't make that on a smaller budget, which would make having those types of risks a little bit more manageable. So I can understand why a studio would be concerned about return for their film. Because if I'm not correct, this is a film that had, what, a $60 million budget? It was a major motion picture, and so especially with the star power that they had. I mean,
did it need to be a $60 million budget? I mean, a huge portion of that budget was wasted on a helicopter chase.
Well, the makeup. I mean, look at all the makeup that they had for the people who are sick, and the makeup was
fairly inconsistent too. It was way heavier towards the beginning, and then towards the end, people didn't look quite as sick. Especially Renee Russo, like she didn't look very sick.
No, that's the thing. Like, it had to show the different stages of the virus. So, like, I guess I'll kind of give it the same way that I talk about the Planet of the Apes movies. When you have only Alien's better. You know, we have Alien. You put all of the emphasis on that one alien, right? And so you put all your makeup on that. When you have only one case of the virus, you want to show it exactly as gruesome and as nasty as you can. That way, when you have 100 or 200 people with the virus, which could you imagine being the makeup artist on that shoot? You don't have to have it as nasty, because at that particular point, you've already gotten in everyone's mind what it should look like. It doesn't take away the fact that you're putting a lot of money into the makeup department, but for time's sake and somewhat for the sake of the... of the amount of work required, so you put the emphasis early on in the film what the Mataba virus looks like.
There's things that look. I make movies, so I understand how the budgets work. But when you're doing like makeup on 100 people, or 150 people, you figure out who the 25 people are who are close to camera. They're the ones who get the heavy makeup. Everybody else gets just enough to be reddish in the face in the background. So really, they're not doing 150 makeups of extreme virus attack.
Yeah.
So I understand that. I know that the green screening, the actual helicopters, getting the big plane for the bomb, the special effect of the bomb exploding in the ocean off the coast, that's where a huge portion of the money went, because special effects in the 90s were incredibly expensive. Way, way more expensive than they are today. As an example, Star Trek, TNG, early 90s and Deep Space Nine, mid 90s. Every time a phaser was fired, it was like $3,500 for the brief moment of the phaser fire. Today, it's like $50, right? Like, visual effects were very expensive in the 90s. That was part and parcel of doing huge visual effects in the 90s. So a big portion of this budget was for that. And again, back to my thing of like, if you just do a story about the virus and you get rid of that conspiracy story where you have to have a military, you know, plane chase, maybe we get a really great film at much less money, right? That's more focused on like the actual villain, which is the virus.
But do you,
and you
think
avoid
audiences
and you avoid the
would...
budget that's blown on the aircraft chase?
Okay. But it comes down to two things that I'd ask. So the film is, in order to get the feel-good ending that they wanted, they have to have this race for the cure, right? They have to cure everyone, which, let's be honest here, considering our own experiences right now with COVID-19...
That's where the science part of this movie completely falls apart?
I seriously doubt that it would take maybe 2 hours to synthesize enough serum for an entire town. Seriously doubt that.
Yeah, but Hollywood always does this to themselves. They shoot themselves in the foot with time, you know, we've got a limited amount of time. Even Rise of Skywalker did the same thing. The final order is going to come and destroy everybody in 18 hours. So the entirety of Rise of Skywalker took place in 18 hours, less than 18 hours. Really? Hollywood's just notoriously bad about like judging time for stuff. So this movie's terrible at it. Okay. The virus like completely destroys the human body in 8 hours. Okay. You know, So Rene Russo comes down with the thing. Okay, now he's got to fly to San Francisco. He's got to do all the research. He's got to find all the things. Then they got to do the chase to get back. They got to capture the monkey first. Which is God knows how long that's going to take. And then they get the chase, and then they get back. Then they got to create a serum and a formula that's going to work. And he's so confident that it's going to work, he takes his helmet off to make her feel better.
Let's be honest here. We kind of had that same trope in Contagion, just a little bit.
But, true. Because Hollywood tropes are Hollywood tropes.
That's true. But here's the thing that I find that I find myself fascinated by when it comes to this movie's decision to get Rene Russo to be, because it's first it was Kevin Spacey, who I don't think nowadays people are going to be too terribly upset that he contracts a deadly virus and dies in the movie. But then Rene Russo. So Kevin Spacey is infected. He's still treating this as something that he's treating it like any other case. Rene Russo gets it, and all of a sudden he's willing to basically terrorize half the country in order to get this monkey. Right? That's the thing that pushes him to the finale. Considering that we already know that he's an obsessive workaholic, we really need him to have that extra motivation?
Yeah, no, he's facing an entire town being annihilated. I think that was enough motivation for this particular character, and as obsessive as he is about stuff.
Because there's one scene which I still love, even considering how over the top it is. It's when J.T. Walsh, as the president's chief of staff, is just lambasting all of these Washington bigwigs about...
You damn well better be on the same page.
I didn't realize who J.T. Walsh was at the time that I saw this movie. But since then, I have become familiar with J.T. Walsh. And I love J.T. Walsh. I love when J.T. Walsh goes the full Pacino.
Yeah.
Like, when he does this, it is beautiful. And no matter how over the top it is, I feel like what he does with this scene, as over the top as it is, he's trying to stress or to provide with the film, stressing just what it is that they're asking. You know, because especially in action movies, when you say, okay, well, you know, you kill 2,600 people to save the lives of everyone, it's easy to kind of look at that, especially in action movie logistics, right? Okay, well, that's not really our world. We don't have to really think about that. It's, you know, the needs of the many, needs of the few. You know, let's go back to Star Trek on that. J.T. Walsh basically shoves it not just in his audience's face, he's shoving it in our face as well. He's not allowing us to have that mentality of this is just logistics. And I really appreciate that, what he does for this particular scene.
Yeah. He's fantastic in it. Hey, Eric, I gotta go grab a different set of headphones because these are about to die. Hold on a second.
Okay, no problem.
We'll be right back. One second. Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So, sorry about that.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and do a clap just so that we know that we're getting back to started. Okay. Okay. Short for when I'm editing. And then we're going to go straight back into where we were.
Okay.
Here we go. All right. So now we've been dancing around around kind of how these characters are playing towards or how this movie dances from the conventional way that it tells the narrative to the kind of the scary things, the thing that was unconventional, especially when it comes to big budget Hollywood movies. Do you think that this was a film that was a stepping stone for Hollywood in dealing with unconventional narratives? Do you think that people or filmmakers saw this movie and, let's say for the sake of argument, Steven Soderbergh, when he made Contagion, saw what Outbreak did and took it to another progression or used that as a stepping stone to make a better movie?
Yeah, you know, I think everything kind of educates the next thing in Hollywood. So in this case, this film does treat the science. Look, they took shortcuts with the ending for sure, but it does treat the science with respect. And I think that was the beginning of a trend in Hollywood over the last 20 years or so, 25 years or so, where science has become more and more respected. I mean, prior to this, most of the time science fiction films really didn't do science well, unless it was Star Trek. But even you could even argue Star Trek makes its liberties with warp drive and whatever else. But generally speaking, they try to treat science with respect as something believable. It's not fantastical. Science is science. It's fact. And I liked the seriousness of the CDC in this movie, the scientists. I mean, to have a plot device that's all about a guy, you know, getting his hose caught in contaminated areas. I mean, that's a natural human thing that could happen in the midst of real science, and that's terrifying. So I like that they treated the science very well, and him trying to hide it. This is Kevin Spacey's character trying to hide the fact that he made a mistake and exposed himself. That's very human. It's stupid, but it's also very human. And that's what makes the movie work, is those moments where the science and humanity kind of collide. Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think it's those moments that educated filmmakers who came behind them, who are making good science fiction films that treat science very respectfully and try to get it as right as possible in the context of telling a good story that's also informed by reality behind it.
You know, I really like that perspective on how this film kind of evolved other films. And yet at the same time, I will say that, you know, looking back at kind of the late 90s, 2000s, because the one thing that we did start to see, and a lot of it you could say is the pre-zombie craze. you know, we did start to see films that was taking advantage of new makeup techniques. New makeup masters were starting to come out of the way. Greg Nicotero, I believe, was becoming a name at this particular point. We were seeing Tom Savini kind of teaching the next generation. Rick Baker and his makeup effects was at its height around this particular point as well.
This was a point where the makeup started looking real too.
Yeah.
You know, believable. And again, I think partly because the makeup artists were paying attention to the science of how stuff actually looks, why it looks the way it looks. It's not just about throwing the makeup on, but understanding why it should look a certain way. And it educates the art.
It does elevate the art, and I feel like Outbreak. You mentioned kind of the makeup effects, and I'm not correct. I don't even think it got nominated for best makeup at the Oscars. But one thing that I think it does do is it creates an atmosphere and it creates an environment that matches the makeup, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You know, when you see, like for me, some of the images that really get me, of course, is the Africa scenes, but the scene of the football field tent city for the infected. You know,
yeah.
when you see people like doing triage in the dugout, when you see, the level of sickness that's going on, the use of the masks, the sallowness of the eyes, even just the slight, like when you're like the first stage of the virus and you just see all this blushness around the cheeks and the puffiness of the skin. And then of course you have the photographs, you know, you see the montage of all the dead, it creates that environment of this could happen. This is possible. This is not a zombie apocalypse. This is happening right now, today. And that reality hits hard when it wants to.
Yeah. And that's when this movie's at its best, is when it's treating that stuff with the utmost respect. And, you know, here in San Diego, with the situation we're in right now with COVID-19, like I was just reading, like our convention center is being converted into a homeless shelter during the outbreak. You know, the tent city stuff is real. I mean, that's what happens. And all of our news right now is terrifying in the best ways that this movie was terrifying. You know, they're talking about not enough hospital beds. We got to convert, abandoned hospitals to become working hospitals again. We're sending military ships, military hospitals to New York and to LA to try and cope, with the overbearing number of victims, right? Overbearing number of cases that are just being dealt with. That's terrifying. And that's when this movie's at its best, is when it's doing that.
I agree. And I guess as we're watching the world kind of face its own apocalypse right now, I'm being a little facetious there, but as we're seeing the outbreak that we are, what lessons do you think that this film itself can provide?
Well, that's one thing where I got upset watching it last night, and I've been upset whenever I've watched these types of movies over the years, because I grew up in a science-based house. My dad was a nuclear engineer. You know, the realities of radiation and stuff were things that I grew up, you know, being educated on from my father. Science has always been really important. The kind of Hollywood ending of this movie, the rapid development of a vaccine, the ability to save all these people miraculously at the last minute, I think sends the wrong message to people that, we can trust the government or anyone to save us quickly. And that's not really the case. As this movie briefly showed, those guys were trying to get out of the town. That kind of selfish behavior is dangerous. And I'm glad they had that in this film. I'm glad they showed it. I think missed another storytelling opportunity by, you know, shooting the one truck and blowing them up. It's the horrors of the government trying to protect people by, you know, being horrible to people. I wish they'd let those guys get out and allow the contagion to continue on. Like, I think that would have been a more realistic story to tell, and could have really kind of expanded on the idea that these things are hard to contain. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're all facing this, you know, stay at home order right now. There's a lot of people out there who just don't want to do it. And they all have various reasons. Some of them because they still don't think it's a big deal. Some of them are young and think they're invincible. Some of them, you know, just, I mean, hey, we live in a country that has a huge anti-vaxxer movement, you know? It's dangerous. People not choosing not to trust facts and not to trust math and science. And I think there are aspects of this film that do a good job of showing that, but they kind of tear all the good they did apart by creating the quick resolution Hollywood ending at the end. So.
Yeah. And I'll be honest here. I feel like Contagion is probably the more scarier of the two films, because that one doesn't, well, that one kind of has a slightly happy ending. The devastation in the in the wake of it is not as definitive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that said, I have to appreciate that Outbreak does give you the sense of no matter what how messed up the government can get, that there are people that are going to fight the virus despite the politics involved. That's something that Contagion gets a little messy with, if I'm being honest.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly believe that Contagion is the better film, easily the better film. But that said, though, it doesn't have helicopter chases. So there's that.
Contagion also has the benefit of being post 9/11.
Yes.
So Outbreak comes out at a time where Americans just haven't seen Americans die on American soil. Like, you know, not in great numbers like that. Post 9/11, you have a population that, like, understands that, you know, hey, bad shit can happen at home. It does. It happens at home occasionally, and it sucks. You also have the benefit of SARS and benefit. You have the unfortunate reality that we've gone through SARS. We've gone through, was swine flu by that point, 2012, around that time. You know, you've had global pandemics, you know, already, that maybe Americans didn't experience necessarily, but they've at least seen it on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the worldwide box office audience, it's familiar territory, and it's stuff that they understand and are fearful of, but maybe want to see it portrayed more seriously in film than Outbreak was. Because Outbreak existed at a time where a lot of Americans and a lot of people around the world, it was a kind of abstract idea, this you know, global pandemic outbreak of something.
So do you think 9/11 matured people to a point where they could have a medical film without requiring goofy one-liners, that it snapped us out of the 90s?
I think it did. Yeah, dramatically. I mean, look at how much television changed after 9/11. Television in the 90s was one thing. It was mostly comedies, and there weren't a lot of really great dramas. But post 9/11, you get 24. You know, that ends up pushing all the way to Homeland, and now you've got Jack Ryan and, like, incredible dramas that are very, very serious, wrapped around terrorism. You know, I mean, it's just what happens in the real world can't help but affect how we consume content afterwards and how content is created for it afterwards as well. And I think we're in a world now where, like, when we see really nasty stuff happen in the world, we want to see movies that, like, movies and television that kind of portray that for us in a real way, because the audience is going to call BS when it doesn't feel real.
I agree. All right. So,
I mean, look at the difference between Gilligan's Island and Lost.
That's true. That is
same basic premise. right? Wildly different takes.
I absolutely agree. All right, so any other thoughts before we come to go to Geek Sheet?
Just that I love Rene Russo.
I
love Rene Russo.
I love Rene Russo. I've been a fan of her since Lethal Weapon 3 and Free Jack.
Well, and I hadn't put together, that Rene Russo was like really one of my like solid favorite actresses in the 90s. Like she feels like she's always just kind of been there, but like the 90s really was when like she kind of took hold, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, technically speaking, I know that she was probably doing something in the 80s, but for me, her first real standout was Free Jack, and then she did Lethal Weapon 3, and then from there, she did a whole bunch of other stuff. We'll talk about that in Geek Sheet. But yeah, I'm so glad that she was able to find that break, and that she has gave us two good decades of work, which we'll talk about in just a moment. All right, so let's go ahead and let's get into Geek Sheet. Well, I was going to start with Hoffman, but let's start with Russo because we're talking about her right now. But obviously, for most of our audience would probably know her as Thor's mom.
That's right.
And can you believe that she has been in 4 Marvel movies, if I'm not correct?
Well, it was what, 2 Thors?
Yeah, two Thors.
2 Thors, Endgame.
Endgame, and then I thought she was in another one, but I could be wrong. So maybe just 3. But she's also, as I mentioned, she was in Lethal Weapons 3 and 4.
So wonderful in those movies. She was such a...
Cole single-handedly saved the Lethal Weapon franchise. Okay, oh. I will make...
She was so brilliant when she showed up in Lethal Weapon. It was such a great injection into the story to have her there.
Well, she could have just been a female Murtaugh, or a female Riggs, but she was her own unique character. She was a great foil for the boys. She gave it energy and life, and she didn't just, you know, especially considering all the other, women in the series, she really stood out. She didn't cower underneath someone else. And so
even when her character's pregnant, she's in there kicking ass. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Like her, a boss. Her character was treated with such respect. It was great.
Like a boss. But also, I have to throw in two of my favorite 90s movies, Get Shorty and The Thomas Crown Affair.
Thomas Crown Affair for the win.
I don't know. I still have a soft spot for Get Shorty. That's
Get Shorty's the better film. But okay. In terms of just appreciating Rene Russo, Thomas Crown Affair for the win.
Yes, definitely.
She's so sultry in that movie. It's amazing.
All right.
What I love about her is she can be believable as the kind of like CDC girl who's like super smart. Mm-hmm. But she can also be that sultry woman. Like what Rene Russo is like a full, complete woman. And she portrays everything on film from being a parent to being a love interest to being a sex symbol. And she does it all and makes it all look completely effortless. She's wonderful.
I agree. Hoffman, I've talked about him once before in The Graduate. I'll just bring up when it comes to his geek creds. He played Captain Hook in Hook, Master Shifu, Kung Fu Panda, and one of the most underappreciated comic book movies of all time, Dick Tracy. I will fight
He was also in the very, very terrible movie Sphere.
We didn't have to say that. Thank you for ruining Dustin Hoffman.
Well, they can't all be.
That's true.
All be winners.
That's true. We could also talk about Ishtar.
Sphere is one of those movies that really pissed me off because I did read that book and then I saw the movie and the movie was such a letdown.
It was boring. To me, when it comes to movies, the worst thing you could ever be. I could appreciate a bad movie as long as it's not boring.
Right.
Boring movies even if it's a good movie, are the worst. But let's talk about Morgan Freeman. Obviously, God, if there ever was...
He hadn't played God at this point yet, had he?
No, he hadn't played God. He played God in Bruce Almighty, which was 2003, if I'm not correct.
Yeah, now he's God all the time.
Yes. But he was in Shawshank Redemption before this, which...
Fantastic film.
Unforgiven, which I believe he got nominated. It was his first nomination, was Unforgiven, if I'm not correct. Wins for Million Dollar Baby. Seven, which we've talked about on this podcast, as well as Shawshank Redemption. And, of course, the Dark Knight Trilogy, where it really does surprise me that, you know, that he is the quintessential... crap, I forgot the character's name now. It's like, he's right on the tip of my tongue. Yeah,
I can't remember his name.
It drives me crazy because I know this character is one of my favorite characters in Batman, and I just completely forgot. Don't you hate when that happens?
Yeah.
But so
we call it going up in the theater.
Evil Donald Sutherland. Obviously, he's like I said, he's known for playing villains. No villain more juicily than the president in Hunger Games.
I was so wonderful in the Hunger Games.
He was. We did talk about Donald Sutherland a little bit in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He did play the hero in that one. Have you ever seen the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
A long, long time ago.
You need to see it again.
When I was very young.
And I will just say this. If you are a fan of Edgar Wright's movies, it was the inspiration for The World's End.
Oh, okay.
So, I personally think The Invasion of Body Snatchers is slightly better than The World's End, but considering that The World's End was my favorite film of 2014, that's saying something. All right, so, I think we talked about Wolfgang Peterson enough. We talked about Das Boot. I will say that there is one sci-fi movie that he, actually two sci-fi movies that people are not aware that he's made. One is The Neverending Story.
Which, one of my absolute favorite films of childhood. Like, my sisters and I wore the VHS tape out.
after he did Das Boot, he did Neverending Story, and history is, as I say, history. But there's another film that he also made, which, in my opinion, was one of the best 80s science fiction movies, or I should say one of the most underrated 80s science fiction movies, which is Enemy Mine. Have you ever seen Enemy Mine?
I love Enemy Mine.
It is a great movie. I don't think it gets enough love. I might have to do it for an Art House Legends because it is that good. But yes.
And I've always wondered if Enemy Mine was part of the inspiration for the Star Trek TNG episode Darmok. Because there's a lot of similarities in the two stories. Give that some thought.
I will definitely give that thought. All right, so at this time, David, do you agree with the critics on Outbreak? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe?
Having been alive in the 90s and understanding what movies in the 90s were like, I will give it a pass. It was a good film for its time.
I will agree with that. But at the same time, I'm going to say...
Bear in mind, I ripped it apart during this
episode. I'm also giving it a pass, primarily because it does deliver what it intended. Is it one of those movies that's going to age in the sense of it being as prevalent or as prominent as it was back in the 90s? Absolutely not. We've matured past this. That said, though, it's fun. It's engaging. The characters are interesting. I was worried that I wasn't going to like the Kevin Spacey character considering what we know about Kevin Spacey now. I still love the character. I can still look past the fact that the person who portrayed him is an absolute creep. And that says something. If you can look past that kind of thing and still see something great. The direction is on point. I love the score by James Newton Howard. His semi-jazz pop, you know, score is... It's basically the same score he did for The Fugitive, right?
Right.
Yeah. But it works. I love the pacing. The editing is really good. With the exception of that one scene. I wish that one scene would have been removed. But outside of that, it's a great movie. It's fun. And you'll have a good time. Maybe a good time is not what you're looking for if you're looking for an end of the world apocalypse movie. But...
Well, and that's just the thing. It's a schizophrenic story.
Hey, that works.
It doesn't quite know what it wants to be, but there's a certain charm in that too. Right. So,
well, David, I want to just say thank you for showing up and doing this episode with me. Where can people find you on the internet?
The easiest thing to do is go to theintellectual.com. That's intellectual with an X, because I think intellects is sexy. So it's intellect and sexuals combined, right? That's where the intellectual podcast can be found, as well as my other podcast, Sci-Fi Sunday, where we rip apart, all things, you know, geek and pop culture. Yeah. And you can also check out my short films and stuff, at that website as well. If you got Amazon Prime, look for Intellectual Entertainment and you might find some of my films there too.
And if you would like to hear more from Art House Legends, you can go ahead and do so on our you can go ahead and do so on our iTunes page, as well as on Stitcher. We're also on Spotify and iHeartRadio. If you would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook page, Art House Legends Podcast, our Twitter feed at Art House Legends, or if you just want to send us a nice little email, tell us how we're doing, both good, bad, or how we just missed the entire point on Outbreak, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and I will get to your emails shortly. David, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is David S. Dawson.
And Phoenix.